So we're roughly halfway through this chapter, Standards of Conduct and Spiritual Freedom, the seventh chapter in the Yoga of Divine Works. Sri Aurobindo's worldview is clearly in the backdrop here, that he has a sense of a natural development which includes the confrontation of various opposites, so that as they collide, a larger harmony is developed, and level after level is reached in an evolution that reveals the hidden secrets in the cosmos. So, many have compared his view of an ascending social order with philosophy of Gian Battista Vico, who wrote in the 18th century and compared historical and cultural evolution to an evolving spiral. You don't move quickly, but you move slowly and successively to higher and higher points of development. And so on one side, you may seem to be making rapid progress, but when you get around to the other side, you seem to be enveloped in darkness again. But eventually, you come out again and enter into the light, and so progress. It's slow. It's like climbing up a winding route around a mountain. You do eventually get to a peak. So both for Vico and for Sri Aurobindo, there is a destiny implied in the formation of the cosmos. There is a purpose, there is a teleological reason embedded in much else that goes on in the universe. It's not the only thing the universe is doing, but there is a teleological goal. This is part of Sri Aurobindo's worldview. So naturally, we move from division towards a concordant unity as well. And so we open with a description here of what nature does in establishing laws of conduct. Why those are overpassed with the development of the individual spirit, how the individual spirit has to concert itself in the context of the social whole, and where they may go after that. Well, we'll go a couple of pages and then pause because of the kind of breaks that we have in the chapter this time. So, the natural law of conduct proceeds from a conflict to an equilibrium of forces, impulsions, and desires. The higher ethical law proceeds by the development of the mental and moral nature towards a fixed internal standard, or else a self-formed ideal of absolute qualities: justice, righteousness, love, right reason, right power, beauty, light. It is, therefore, essentially an individual standard. It is not a creation of the mass mind. So again, you can see that the context here is going to be individual versus collective, liberty versus social equality, democracy versus socialism. This is implied in the background. The thinker is the individual. It is he who calls out and throws into forms that which would otherwise remain subconscious in the amorphous human whole. The moral striver is also the individual. Self-discipline, not under the yoke of an outer law, but in obedience to an internal light, is essentially an individual effort. And here we can go back to the Greeks. But by positing his personal standard As the translation of an absolute moral ideal, the thinker imposes it not on himself alone, but on all the individuals whom his thought can reach and penetrate. So implicitly, the individual rises within the context of a collectivity which could potentially be resistant to the light that he wishes to impart. And the light that he wishes to impart is the illumination of a single individual that he says this should become a categorical, well, I'm borrowing a phrase from Kant, should become an imperative for all. And as the mass of individuals come more and more to accept it in idea, if only in an imperfect practice or no practice, society also is compelled to obey the new orientation. It absorbs the ideative influence and tries, not with any striking success, to mold its institutions into new forms touched by these higher ideals. But always, its instinct is to translate them into binding law, into pattern forms, into mechanic custom, into an external social compulsion upon its living units. So the individual authors an ideal, which is then widely imposed on all. This shall be so, and this is the law that all shall undertake, all shall obey. For long after the individual has become partially free, a moral organism capable of conscious growth, aware of an inward life, eager for spiritual progress, society continues to be external in its methods, a material and economic organism, mechanical, more intent upon status and self-preservation than on growth and self-perfection. So there's the tension. And he describes here what he means by being partially free. You're capable of growth, becoming aware of your inner being. You want to progress, but you're held back by the demands of society. He says, no, you must serve and satisfy us first. If we have room left for you, then you can grow a little. The greatest present triumph of the thinking and progressive individual over the instinctive and static society has been the power he has acquired by his thought will to compel it to think also, to open itself to the idea of social justice and righteousness, communal sympathy and mutual compassion, to feel after the rule of reason rather than blind custom as the test of its institutions, and to look on the mental and moral ascent of its individuals as at least one essential element in the validity of its laws. Ideally, at least, to consider light rather than force as its sanction, moral development and not vengeance or restraint as the object even of its penal action, is becoming just possible to the communal mind. Well, it's a rather distant possibility still. The greatest future triumph of the thinker will come when he can persuade the individual integer and the collective whole to rest their life relation and its union and stability upon a free and harmonious consent and self-adaptation, and shape and govern the external by the internal truth rather than to constrain the inner spirit by the tyranny of the external form and structure. So here he's expecting that we will evolve into a reversal of the order of being. Rather than rely on externalizing custom and routine, that we would be able to live in the spontaneity of a spirit that recognizes the needs of a community, that we would be individualistic in essence, but communitarian in our approach, so that the individual would not disrupt the whole, but would enlighten it, enrich it. But even this success that he has gained is rather a thing in potentiality than in actual accomplishment. There is always a disharmony and discord between the moral law in the individual and the law of his needs and desires, between the moral law proposed to society and the physical and vital needs, desires, customs, prejudices, interests, and passions of the caste, the clan, the religious community, the society, the nation. So here we see the law versus the desire in both the individual and in the collective. The moralist erects in vain his absolute ethical standard and calls upon all to be faithful to it without regard to consequences. To him, the needs and desires of the individual are invalid if they are in conflict with the moral law. And the social law has no claims upon him if it is opposed to his sense of right and denied by his conscience. This is his absolute solution for the individual, that he shall cherish no desires and claims that are not consistent with love, truth, and justice. He demands from the community or nation that it shall hold all things cheap, even its safety and its most pressing interests, in comparison with truth, justice, humanity, and the highest good of the peoples. Well, this is the position of the moralist. Sri Aurobindo noted in a conversation in 1925 with Lajpat Rai that the lust for power, the lust for power, will always be present, even in the best of those who champion democracy, that it is natural for them to compete and fight for ultimate authority. But still, this is a formulated ideal which the moralist holds. Champion love, truth, and justice. No individual rises to these heights except in intense moments. No society yet created satisfies this ideal. And in the present state of morality and of human development, none perhaps can or ought to satisfy it. Nature will not allow it. Nature knows that it should not be. The first reason is that our moral ideals are themselves, for the most part, ill-evolved, ignorant, and arbitrary. Mental constructions rather than transcriptions of the eternal truths of the spirit. So nature cancels our ideal. We are unwise and we are partial in outlook, and so nature does not permit it to go forward. Authoritative and dogmatic, they assert certain absolute standards in theory, but in practice, every existing system of ethics proves either an application unworkable or is in fact a constant coming short of the absolute standard to which the ideal pretends. If our ethical system is a compromise or a makeshift, it gives at once a principle of justification to the further sterilizing compromises which society and the individual hasten to make with it. And if it insists on absolute love, justice, right, with an uncompromising insistence, it soars above the head of human possibility and is professed with lip homage, but ignored in practice. Homage, acknowledging the greater man, is what it means. Even if, pardon me, even it is found that it ignores other elements in humanity which equally insist on survival but refuse to come within the moral formula. For just as the individual law of desire contains within it valuable elements of the infinite whole which have to be protected against the tyranny of the absorbing social idea, the innate impulses too, both of individual and of collective man, contain in them invaluable elements which escape the limits of any ethical formula yet discovered and are yet necessary to the fullness and harmony of an eventual divine perfection. So, there's a justice in the individual law of desire, something that nature wishes to articulate. Desire is not something that ought to be crushed, but ought to be transformed. And there is a yet unarticulated soul-seeking in the individual and collective to which Sri Aurobindo refers here. He doesn't give it full scope. He doesn't define it. But there is that marriage of their interests which is possible to human society. Moreover, absolute love, absolute justice, absolute right reason in their present application by a bewildered and imperfect humanity come easily to be conflicting principles. Justice often demands what love abhors. We might note here that Sri Aurobindo had a great faith in democracy until he came to Pondicherry. And having seen what happened in the play of democracy there, said that it had robbed him of his faith. He made that observation in 1924 again in one of his evening talks. Right reason, dispassionately considering the facts of nature and human relations, in search of a satisfying norm or rule, is unable to admit without modification either any reign of absolute justice or any reign of absolute love. They fight each other. And in fact, man's absolute justice easily turns out to be, in practice, a sovereign injustice. For his mind, one-sided and rigid in its constructions, puts forward a one-sided, partial, and rigorous scheme or figure and claims for it totality and absoluteness and an application that ignores the subtler truth of things and the plasticity of life. So here, you might look at this integral view that Sri Aurobindo is espousing and regard it in combination with Jean Gebser's idea of an aperspectival view, something that does not claim only one perspective but is capable of seeing all without marrying itself to any particular and thus reach a wholeness. Sri Aurobindo is talking about a wholeness here. All our standards turned into action either waver on a flux of compromises or err by this partiality and unelastic structure. Humanity sways from one orientation to another. The race moves upon a zigzag path led by conflicting claims, and on the whole, works out instinctively what nature intends, but with much waste and suffering, rather than either what it desires or what it holds to be right, or what the highest light from above demands from the embodied spirit. You see, the supramental towards which he's driving this argument, an evolution into a unit of consciousness which holds within its oneness vast diversity could not be constricted in such a dichotomy. It must be able to breathe in all of it. So Sri Aurobindo, in writing some of this, has already mentioned that these ideals are self-limiting and artificial, and he applied it to Gandhi's Satyagraha, his system of achieving truth in action, saying in a conversation that it was, by its own definition, self-defeated. Because when pressed, Gandhi said that nobody knew what Satyagraha was except for himself. So we go back to this idea that the moralist, the person that writes the edict that should become popularly adhered to, is an individual. And that individual, of course, has a perspective, and that perspective is incomplete. So Gandhi's ideal is mind-born, conceived within dualism. And you can see its effects, as far as it was able to be practiced, was quite destructive, and the actual succession of events in India and led to the division of that country into Pakistan, East and West, and India in between. It didn't have to happen, but for the schismatic view that each side had, and Gandhi played into it, rather than having based himself in a unifying soul vision, he founded his philosophy on mere rationality. He was a Tolstoyan. He was not grounded in the views of Vedanta, but in the views of Western philosophy. Sri Aurobindo noted that he had foreseen that socialism would take away individual freedom and had abandoned it. Actually, he was in neither camp, neither for socialism nor for democracy, because the individual is always part of the whole, and the whole grows by the growth of the individual. So to try to separate the two or try to emphasize one over the other is an error. To try to impose a law on someone, especially a budding awakening soul, is a violence to that spirit. A lower order of humanity probably benefits from rational order, etc. And if Dharma, as formulated in India, serves that purpose, then Dharma has a role. But when Arjuna is on the battlefield at Kurukshetra and has to decide what is his proper path, what is he going to do, all the dharmas conflict and collide, and he's bewildered and has nowhere to go. So then he has to be introduced to a spiritual consciousness which transcends, comes back, and then unifies and permits an action which is precise, divinely guided, regardless of whether it throws morality into discord and disarray or not. One can always act divinely. So that is where we would be led. We'll have occasion to talk about Dharma in a couple of pages as we move farther into Sri Aurobindo's argument. And maybe we can put that in some context, where the idea comes from, how it brought cohesiveness in some ways to Indian society, and where it failed it. So I think we've reached that point where we can place a bookmark again. I know it's a little early. Some of you may be glad of it. We'll turn to savitri and move to book two, the book of the traveler of the worlds. This is in canto 11. The kingdoms and godheads of the greater mind. Audacious in their sense of God-born strength, these dared to grasp with their thought truth's absolute. By an abstract purity of godless sight, by a percept nude, intolerant of forms, they brought to mind what mind could never reach, and hoped to conquer truth's supernal base. A stripped imperative of conceptual phrase, architectonic and inevitable, translated the unthinkable into thought. A silver-winged fire of naked subtle sense, an ear of mind withdrawn from the outward's rhymes, discovered the seed sounds of the eternal word, the rhythm and music heard that built the worlds, and seized in things the bodiless will to be. The illimitable they measured with numbers rods, and traced the last formula of limited things in transparent systems, bodied termless truths, the timeless made accountable to time, and valued the incommensurable supreme. To park and hedge the ungrasped infinitudes, they erected absolute walls of thought and speech, and made a vacuum to hold the one. In their sight, they drove towards an empty peak, a mighty space of cold and sunlit air. To unify their task, excluding life which cannot bear the nakedness of the vast, they made a cipher of a multitude, in negation found the meaning of the all, and in nothingness the absolute positive. A single law simplest the cosmic theme, compressing nature into a formula. Their titan labor made all knowledge one, a mental algebra of the spirit's ways, an abstract of the living divinity. Here the mind's wisdom stopped. It felt complete, for nothing more was left to think or know. In a spiritual zero it sat throned and took its vast silence for the ineffable. This was the play of the bright gods of thought, attracting into time the timeless light, imprisoning eternity in the hours. This they have planned, to snare the feet of truth in an aureate net of concept and of phrase, and keep her captive for the thinker's joy in his little world built of immortal dreams. There must she dwell, mured in the human mind, an impress prisoner in her subject's house, adored and pure and still on his heart's throne, his splendid property cherished and apart in the wall of silence of his secret muse, immaculate in white virginity, the same forever and forever one, his worshipped changeless goddess through all time. Or else, a faithful consort of his mind, assenting to his nature and his will, she sanctions and inspires his words and acts, prolonging their resonance through the listening years, companion and recorder of his march, crossing a brilliant tract of thought and life carved out of the eternity of time. A witness to his high, triumphant star, her godhead servitor to a crowned idea, he shall dominate by her a prostrate world, a warrant for his deeds and his beliefs. She attests his right divine to lead and rule. Or as a lover clasps his one beloved, godhead of his life's worship and desire, icon of his heart's soul idolatry, she now is his and must live for him alone. She has invaded him with her sudden bliss, an exhaustless marvel in his happy grasp, an allurement, a caught, ravishing miracle. Her now he claims, after long rapt pursuit, the one joy of his body and his soul. Inescapable is her divine appeal, her immense possession, an undying thrill, an intoxication, and an ecstasy. The passion of her self-revealing moods, a heavenly glory and variety, makes ever new her body to his eyes, or else repeats the first enchantment's touch, the luminous rapture of her mystic breasts and beautiful vibrant limbs, a living field of throbbing new discovery without end. A new beginning flowers in word and laugh. A new charm brings back the old extreme delight. He is lost in her. She is his heaven here. Truth smiled upon the gracious golden game. Out of her hushed, eternal spaces leaned the great and boundless goddess, feigned to yield the sunlit sweetness of her secrecies. Incarnating her beauty in his clasp, she gave, for a brief kiss, her immortal lips, and drew to her bosom one glorified mortal head. She made earth her home, for whom heaven was too small. Well, in a human breast, her occult presence lived. He carved from his own self his figure of her. She shaped her body to a mind's embrace. Into thought's narrow limits she has come. Her greatness she has suffered to be pressed into the little cabin of the idea, the closed room of a lonely thinker's grasp. She has lowered her heights to the stature of our souls, and dazzled our lids with her celestial gaze. Thus each is satisfied with his high gain, and thinks himself beyond mortality blessed, a king of truth upon his separate throne. To her possessor in the field of time, a single splendor caught from her glory seems the one true light, her beauty's glowing whole. So, he mocks our ideal. Namaste, Jai Ma.